the strange and incomprehensible artifacts, the sealed crates of exotic foodstuffs he brought back time and again after each trawl through the Deathlands. The man called Scale handed the glasses back to his companion. He gazed up at the dark sky broodingly, calculating that there was an hour to dawn. No hint of a smile crossed his face, but his dead eyes had come alive.
Traitor.
The traitor?
Yeah, let's take him.
We're gonna take the traitor?
Yeah, Reed, that's what I said.
I don't know, Scale. He's heavy.
So are we.
No, not like him. You hear what he did in Cooperville? They tried to mess with him. He tore the place down, right down to the ground, wiped it out. Massacred everyone, too. Men, women, children, even the animals. Didn't take them for himself, just slaughtered the herds and left the carcasses and split.
That's bullshit. We hit him in the dark. Three war wags, front, middle, rear. Can't turn in the pass. Too narrow. So go for him and hit him hard. We got the muscle. We disable the middle so it blocks the road. Rear trucks can't go forward. Front can't go back. We hit both ends simultaneous. They ain't got a prayer.
Well, it sounds good, but goddamn, Scale, he's got muscle.
Sure. So have we.
Not like him.
I say we do it.
The long-armed man turned to stare down into the darkness, cloaking the patiently waiting band of men below.
Hell blast, Scale! We already got us a catch. Two land wags trucking out to the darks.
Ain't enough. Any case, it's the ammo. Traitor, he's got plenty of ammo. Plenty of guns. Big mothers.
Plenty of men, too.
Nah, he travels light from what I hear. That's a lot of big wind about his manpower. These days, he travels light.
Where'd you hear that?
Fat Harry. Last time he was here. Said the traitor was getting to be an old man, thinking of quitting. And we can hurry that along. Quit the fucker ourselves.
I don't know, Scale. The traitor.
Don't forget what we got.
We ain't got nothing.
Horseshit. We got the stickies, idiot. We got the stickies.
In the lead war wagon, in a small toilet cubicle to the rear, the traitor was being sick. He knelt on the swaying floor, gripping the sides of the aluminum bowl, and heaved four or five times, finally slumping back on his heels against the wall of the cubicle. He was sweating. He wiped his brow with a rag, then wiped his lips, carefully, almost delicately. The noise of the war wag's powerful engine thundered in his ears, and he was glad of it. It meant no one could hear him or what he was doing. He clambered to his feet, a powerfully built man with stiff, grizzled hair, and stared down at the contents of the bowl dispassionately. He knew exactly what to expect. Blood. But this time, more of it than ever. Almost looked as if he was hawking his whole nuke-shitting guts up. The traitor stared at himself thoughtfully. A face he saw every day of every week, of every month, of every year. But older. Definitely older. Much older than yesterday. A hell of a sight older than last week. White, too. Unhealthy looking. Once his face used to be red-brown, vigorous, alive. He kicked the flush pedal beside the bowl.
The hell with it.
He reached up and opened a small cabinet fixed to the wall. Inside were shelves of bottles and jars. His eyes took in the various colors, considered the positions of each container. As he could neither read nor write, it was the only way he could distinguish their contents. He took down a bottle of green liquid, uncapped it, wiped the neck with his rag, and took a long swig. He twisted the tap, and water from the tank in the roof washed the green liquid away. He put the bottle back and lit a cigar. That would take the smell of peppermint away, right enough.
Probably the only mouthwash within a few 100,000 kilometers. Weird stuff.
The mouthwash had been stored deep down someplace, freak material survivors of fire and ice, and was often to be found in huge amounts. Factory fresh, it sometimes said on the labels. There weren't many of these finds, but there were some, and they were mighty strange in their bright packaging and their huge quantities. Such caches were usually buried deep under rubble, And if it was a huge, sparkling supply of mouthwash that you found after all that digging, you were more than likely to think it not worth the effort. Unless you were the trader. He liked the stuff. He liked the joke inherent in luxury products, suddenly found in quantities far out of all proportion to their usefulness. He slapped at his face, his cheeks, hard, to get some color back, then squared his shoulders. He took a long pull at his moldy old cigar and let the smoke drool out of his mouth. Then he pulled open the door. The trader moved fast down the narrow passageway outside. On his right was a machine gun blister, occupied by a dark-skinned youth who briefly nodded to him before letting his eyes flick back to the port above the gun and to the rushing darkness outside the bulletproof glass. The trader, cigar firmly clamped between uneven yellow teeth, walked on, climbed some steps, and pulled himself into the main cabin area of the vehicle. It had once been a mobile army command post, long, long ago, back when there had been an army to command. It had been his very first acquisition, maybe a score and a half years ago. He and Marsh Folsom had discovered it while escaping from a bunch of cannies in the Apps, or the Appalachians, as some old folks insisted on calling them. A rock slide, old, maybe triggered originally by nuke tremors, had uncovered a vast man-made cavern, reaching deep into the heart of the thickly wooded slopes. Inside was Golconda. That was what Marsh, a man who'd read books, had said, as they'd stared in awe at the rows and rows of parked vehicles, all kinds, all types, that stretched away from them into the gloom. The MCP had been the nearest, a huge mother, though not as huge as she was now. Over the years, the trader had added to it, affixing gun ports here, rocket pods there, machine gun blisters everywhere. Once he'd started a business, he'd recruited reliable men and used the Appalachian Cavern as his main HQ. His engineers had fixed pierced steel planking double thickness all around the MCP, modified the interior, and rewired it to his specifications, adapted and strengthened it. It was now a death-dealing juggernaut, capable of considerable speed on the flat, with retractable tracks for the rough terrain over which it surged with incredible vitality for its bulk. It was also the flagship of the trader's fleet of war wags, land wags, trucks, powered vehicles, and personnel carriers. The barons of the East had their ramshackle armies, their trucks, their materiel, their war wags, but it was pretty much penny-ante stuff, and in any case, most of it had been supplied by the trader directly. He couldn't and didn't want to stop the slow march of a manufacturing industry that had started in a small way a generation back. The crude electrification of small plants in certain places, mostly based on the utilization of 100-year-old equipment that had survived, knowledge gained from old manuals and handed down memories and skills. But he could still see to it that he and he alone controlled the heavy hardware that had been salted away so many years before. He still had his secrets, though there were many who plotted and schemed in smoke-filled rooms to wrest them from him, many who saw him as the ultimate block to their own acquisition of power. The trader's philosophy had changed through the years. At first, he'd sold, bartered, and traded damned near anything and everything he could lay his hands on for gold, coin, and creds. His success was due solely to his own natural vigor and energy and the smartness of Marsh Folsom, who could read and write, and because of this could go some way to deciphering some of the meager clues they had found in the original Apps caverns and other stockpiles. Folsom knew from his reading that the old-timers used incredibly complex pieces of machinery called computers, and he figured that much of the paperwork they had found in the stockpiles had a lot to do with those things. But unless you had been trained how to use them, there was no way you could crack the code. Although both he and the trader had actually seen these computer machines in their travels around the Deathlands, mostly wrecked, unsalvageable, though there'd been some that had appeared intact, you also needed power, a lot of power, to turn the blasted things on. And even if you could somehow work it, Folsom knew they'd still be useless, because no one could comprehend how to handle them. A live machine you didn't understand was as redundant as a dead one you did, maybe more so. Still, they'd persevered. Folsom had followed up clues on military maps, had pinpointed locations, areas of possibility. The trader had gone out to those locations and dug around, sometimes hitting pay dirt, more often than not, drawing one big fat zero. The percentage against them over the years was depressingly high. In every 10 tries, maybe one was on target. Their second major find had been a sea of gas in vast containers hidden below the peaks of the mountain range that stretched toward the cold zone to the north, maybe 200 kilometers beyond the ruins of Boston. It had been a bitch to transport shipments of it the enormous distance back to the Appalachians through rugged and dangerous terrain, frequently fighting a running battle with muties, cannies, mannies, the muties with precog powers even more eerie than the doomies, and sheerly vicious norms who attacked from crazed bloodlust alone. But out of that terrifying odyssey had grown the trader's band, for although Folsom played around with his maps and files, the trader recognized the more immediate need for a satellite recrutment, a nucleus of hard-case guards and blasters who would fall in with his ideas, obey orders, and keep their mouths shut tight. That had taken time. He couldn't simply grab the first guys who came along. The trader wanted, needed, integrity in his followers, fearlessness, nerve, a resolute loyalty, and maybe something approaching devotion. And once he'd got what he wanted, or as nearly as he decided he was ever going to get, he ran a tight ship. You wanted creds? You worked for them. You wanted a life that, hard as it might be, was a hell of a sight easier than that experienced by the vast majority of the Deathlands dwellers? You had to earn it. You wanted sex? You either got yourself a solid partner, or you paid for it. It was readily available. There were plenty of burgs in the Deathlands that were simply open brothels. What you did not do, however, was grab it any old damned where. You did not use force. You did not kill to get it. Anybody who did, and was caught, faced summary execution, no reprieve. It was one of the trader's iron rules. Even when he destroyed Cooperville, there'd been no rape. It was one of the things that had bolstered his rep, given him the key to all those small towns that were tight little enclaves, well-defended, well-manned. All those small towns with their strong guard units who turned away other lesser traders who were not so choosy in the way they conducted their business, who were, when you got down to it, little more than marauding bands of killers and cutthroats, looters and pillagers. That was not, and never had been, the trader's way. And most recognized this in the Deathlands, and welcomed him with open arms instead of gun barrels. Still, his methods had changed over the years. Whereas before he'd been willing to get shot of all he came across for the best price he could find, now he held back on much he discovered in his foraging trips. In his early days, he'd let too many guys have too much hardware, too much high-powered hardware, and it seemed to him now that such a practice had been not merely unwise, but an outright disaster, whose hideous ramifications lingered with him still. He had come to realize that, unwittingly, thoughtlessly, greedily, he had armed groups whose aims were by no means altruistic, whose ideas were, in fact, solely concentrated on power for its own sake. As the years had gone by, the trader had brooded long on the guns problem and had still come up with no firm solution. You had to have weapons to defend yourself. In an ordered world, maybe, you relied on those forces you yourself set up to guard your rights and liberties, hold the peace, defend the weak against the strong. And even then, even in the most orderly society there might ever have been, there would still be those who secretly sought evil, and who therefore preyed on the less fortunate. And what if those who carried the weapons, those whom you'd set up, turned against you, were corrupted by the very power you had bestowed upon them? It happened. It always happened. Marsh Folsom, who knew about these things, had said it happened all the time, throughout recorded history. Because the trouble was that for some people, power was a heady drug. The more they had, the more they wanted. It was that simple. And yet it seemed to the trader, thinking about such things, arguing the problem out with his captains through the long watches of the night over many years, that though in a sense he'd been dead wrong to let loose all that vicious ordinance he'd discovered, in a sense he'd been dead right. There was no denying that he had armed certain communities, deep in the wilder reaches of the Deathlands, that because of him had stayed intact and had flourished, when by all rights they ought to have gone under, been ravaged by the fire-blasting drivers and muties and crazies who roamed the land. At least with weapons, they'd stood a chance. The fact was, whichever way you cut it, a weaponless burg didn't have a hope. Not now. Not in these wild times. The trader had seen what could happen to such communities too often to deny this. There had been many towns, mostly of a strong religious persuasion of one kind or another, that had denounced violence, renounced weaponry. that had proclaimed a new era of peace and harmony following the apocalypse. All had fallen prey to the men of violence who had renounced nothing. Sometimes they had merely been invaded, enslaved. Sometimes, dreadfully, serfdom had been the least of their woes. The traitor acknowledged to himself and to those closest to him that the blame for many of these atrocities had to find its way back to him. He sometimes wondered how in hell what passed for civilization these days had managed to make it through the past 100 years or so, not only through the cold, which by all accounts had been grim enough, but beyond, when folks had started crawling out of their holes to grab what was left after the collapse. It was true that the nuke had not destroyed everything, and it was equally true that somehow thousands had managed to make it through those long years when it was said that the sun had died. From what the traitor had heard from that generation, it was a time of horror and a time of terror, and in many ways it had gotten worse when, especially in the East, the seasons had slowly begun to return, and people had started to drag themselves into the daylight of a new and terrifyingly transformed world. But having acknowledged his culpability in the matter of trading in the kind of materials that might better have been left undiscovered, he nevertheless felt that in some small way he had also been able to lift people back onto their feet again by rediscovering creation. For in these strange and secret stockpiles were generators, survival equipment, processed food that could last for centuries if necessary, tools, fuel, the means to learn, the means to expand, the means to grow. All this, too, the trader had hauled around the Deathlands, leaving communities better equipped to battle with the ever-looming dark that still threatened to overwhelm what was left. And whereas before he'd been greedy, careless in his dealings, now he was more scrupulous, more circumspect. Now there were things he discovered, then swiftly reburied. He still broke out in a sweat when he recalled the time, 5 or 6 years before, when Ryan and Dix had followed up a lead left by Marsh Folsom and found buried in the hills of what had once been a place called Kentucky an immense collection of sealed airtight drums, tens of thousands of them, all neatly tabbed and docketed, all with that deadly and unmistakable symbol stamped into their casings. The juice they called nerve gas. Hundreds of thousands of liters of it. The same kind of shit that had rained down during the nuke from both sides, leaving an appalling legacy behind it, a legacy that still lingered and would still linger for decades, maybe generations, far into the bleak future. They'd closed down the cavern, the trader and Ryan and Dix, buried the entrance under a controlled landslip, destroyed all the paperwork that had led Marsh Folsom into pinpointing the area as a stockpile possibility in the first place, and hoped for the best. It was all you could do. But it still gave the traitor nightmares when he slept, still gave him the shakes when he awoke. Because there was always the outside chance that some other guy might just fall over it, even buried as it was, somehow, sometime. There was always that chance. Some guy by no means is scrupulous, some guy who might well figure out a way of actually using it, of bringing even more horror to a world already stuffed with horror up to the gullet. There were times when the traitor felt burdened with the immense weight of secrets he had uncovered, the vast power he had but could not use, the huge guilt load he, and he alone, now that Marsh Folsom had gone, inescapably carried. Sure, he had Ryan and Dix. The situation was tight with them, as with no one else he could think of. But they had only arrived in the past 10 years. Less. They'd not been with him since the beginning, all those years ago. The weight they carried was lighter by far than the tremendous and often crushing burden that seemed at times ready to pulverize his soul. And now the blood. That was a new and special weight on him, because, apart from anything else, it put a horizon to his life, a horizon that he was inevitably getting closer to by the month, by the day, by the hour.
Fire blast.
He sucked at the cigar, took it out of his mouth, blew smoke into the air. His head buzzed. His arms and legs felt as though they'd been fashioned out of lead. He felt old. He felt he knew what it must be like to be 110. He was only 53. The trader glared at his war captain as the man strode across the white cabin towards him. Raven-haired, the young man called Ryan Cotter stood just over 6 feet in his boots, yet seemed far taller. You okay?
Sure I'm okay. Can't a fella take a crap once in a while?
The trader had known instantly, the first time he'd seen Ryan, that here was a man he could not only entrust with his life, but one who could inspire trust in others, a man for whom other men might well lay down their own lives. That was a dangerous power to own, and there was no denying that Ryan could be a dangerous man. He was rangy, limber, yet powerfully muscled, with a shock of thick, night-dark curly hair. He had a single eye, intensely, chillingly blue, able to penetrate to the very core of a man's being, and a long scar slash from corner of eye to corner of mouth that no amount of sunlight could burn brown, and that at times of stress and fury seemed almost to glow with a livid fire. This man was a fierce and relentless war captain. Yet that was by no means the whole story, as the trader well knew. Ryan was no mindless human bludgeon intent on berserk savagery to gain a particular goal, but a cunning, wily fighter, a realist, a pragmatist who would battle against all odds, yet knew to the instant when to retire in good order, when to conserve his forces. The circumstances of their first meeting had not been auspicious. It was hard to think about trusting a person when that person had a heavy caliber automatic jammed into the back of your skull and was whispering in your ear that one stupid move would bring about instant dissolution of the brain pan. At the time, the trader had been sitting at the wheel of his personal war buggy, and in fact, just 5 seconds before, had unlocked it and climbed in after checking that all the locks were secure and no one had been tampering with them. So much for security. So much for the anti-personnel device that ought instantly to have taken the arm off any guy who so much as touched the outside of the damn door. But Ryan was good with locks, although even now he acknowledged the superiority of J.B. Dix when it came to the lockpicker's art. It was one of Ryan's finer points, the ability, if a guy was more skillful than he, to recognize the fact and admit it. And also, of course, he was on the run. These elements combined meant that the trader's super-secure and seemingly impregnable war buggy was easy meat. The trader had been finishing some business in one of the then-typical roaring towns in the center of the Deathlands, and he had been only too willing to put his foot down when ordered, and in the muttered words of the unseen man crouching behind him, "Get the hell out, fast." The Landwag train had been waiting for him and ready to go, a couple of clicks out of town. This was clearly no surprise to the stranger, who had chosen his getaway vehicle with great care. When they'd both climbed out of the vehicle, and the trader had turned and gazed at the man who was still covering him, he'd made up his mind on the instant. He had known with complete and utter certainty that this was the guy he wanted, the guy he'd been unconsciously searching for years. With the automatic still pointed unwaveringly at him, at a point just below his heart, he had offered the unknown man a place in his organization. The unknown man, just as swiftly, had shrugged his shoulders, holstered the shooter, and accepted. He called himself Ryan, but had offered nothing else about himself. Not his background, close kin, place of origin, taste in women, nothing. In particular, he had not explained why he was on the run or who he was running from. It had taken the trader some time, about 5 years, to piece a pattern together, put Ryan into some kind of context. Even now there were blank pages, areas where information was not so much sketchy as entirely absent. But at least he had come to know who Ryan was and why he had landed up in the Deathlands as a runner, an outcast. At least he now knew why the guy refused trips to certain of the eastern baronies, why he never spoke about his past, why at times he never spoke, period. And at least he knew why he lacked an eye. It was difficult for the trader to identify why he had trusted Ryan on sight, and it was especially difficult, almost impossible in fact, to sustain that trust when he discovered who Ryan really was and what he had done, or at least what he was supposed to have done. That was so grisly a crime, so appalling, so outright wicked an act of sheer malevolence and evil, that even by the pretty abysmal standards of what passed for civilization in the late 21st century, it had hit an all-time low. A man who did that wasn't fit to live. And yet, instinct, his prime and priceless asset, worth more to him than all the jack, all the spare change in the known world, because it had never yet let him down, told the trader that this was a man of probity, a man of honesty and integrity, a man of high courage, who would never stoop to a mean act or betray a trust. And so it had proved. From day one of their now decade-long association, the trader had not regretted taking the guy on, not for a second. He'd had moments of doubt, one or two, such as when he'd fitted that highly significant, not to say shocking, piece into the jigsaw that portrayed the man's past, but they'd not lasted long. The trader had backed his instinct, and as far as he was concerned, once again, it had not betrayed him. The war wagon bucked violently and lurched to one side, then righted itself under the skillful hands of its driver, Chess. J.B. Dix, seated in the co-driver's swivel chair, smoking a long, thin black cheroot that looked as unappetizing as the trader's cigar, half turned to stare impassively back at his chief.
You want to complain about this road, boss? It's a disgrace.
Teague's territory, J.B., or what he claims is his. Road care's a low priority around here. He's got other things to occupy his mind.
Or what passes for his mind. Right, Ryan?
Yeah, like how to dig up more of the yellow stuff at less cost. Or no cost at all.
Then how's he pulling that off?
Slaving.
He's getting to be a big man. Got a lot of boot.
Come a long way.
J.B. Dix sucked on his crudely rolled cheroot. He was the trader's main lieutenant, known as the weapons master. Whereas the trader was merely a businessman, it was Dix who had the knowledge of weaponry, booby traps, and so on. A thin, intense, bespectacled man with a receding hairline, a penchant for thin black cheroots, a fast but very devious mind, and a terse, monosyllabic conversational style, it was Dix the weapons master's destiny to become a close personal ally of Ryan. The Warwag's engine bellowed throatily as Chess took her up the dial. In front of him, across the front of the cab and below the narrow, bulletproof see-through windshield, was a bewildering array of screens and dials, button sets, and circuit breakers. Not many of these were in use. Originally all, including the huge vehicle's weaponry, had been linked to a central control computer. But as no one had ever been able to figure out how it worked, the trader's mechs had ripped the guts out of everything and started over. Only the fascia remained, to confuse any hijacker who, through some incredible stroke of good fortune, might manage to get inside the Warwag's cabin.
The way I see it, Teague's come a damn sight too far. We've been through this 1,000 times, Ryan. My word is my bond. You ought to know that by now. It's the only reason I've stayed in business. 2 years ago, I took Teague's hand and promised him a fat delivery. That's what we have here, and I can't back out. Fire blast it, man! You know damn well I've pulled back on everything. He wanted 20 cases of auto rifles, he's getting 8. He wanted 15 boxes of grenades, he's getting 6. And those are stun, not frag. And he knows we know the difference. I've pared the whole consignment to the bone, and he's not going to be happy.
Too bad. The guy's a leech. He's getting more greedy and more dirty by the hour. He'll screw us if he thinks he can. And the way things are, that's exactly what's going to happen.
I know that. I know all about Jordan Teague. Hell, I traded stuff with the son of a bitch from the very first cache 25 years ago. Or thereabouts. He was a rat then, and he's a rat now. I know it. But I shook his hand. The deal goes through.
The trader swung around and glared at no one in particular. Dix was staring at the radiant ribbon of road, picked out by the twin spotlights located high above the cab, protected by wire mesh against a sniper's bullets. Darkness clung to the light's penumbra. The highway unwound before them, potholed and rutted. Ryan leaned against the steel ladder that led up to the MG blister built into the roof of the cabin. He shrugged, glanced at Cone.
How long?
About a half an hour to dawn. Hills ahead, the road goes up. That'll slow us. Pass through the hills, and beyond that, maybe 2 hours to Moxon.
We stop 5 clicks out. Take this one and the 2 big trucks in. If I know Teague, we'll have to wait a day before the bastard will see us.
He's getting fancy as well as greedy.
He's a rich man, Ryan. He knew folks had come back to gold. He knew it'd be in demand someday. So he created the demand. He hurried things along. Smart businessman.
And prime shit.
Sure. Like every businessman since the world began. Or so I'm told. Like me.
Ryan walked to the rear of the cabin. There was a passageway that led to the armory, the bunk rooms, the kitchen facility. He knew Lowe's, the cook, would be preparing breakfast. To his left were steps leading down to the toilet. He stared down the short shaft up which the trader had so recently emerged, jauntily waving his cigar. He could still smell the fumes trapped down there, the fumes that, on the trader himself, powerful as they were, had not quite hidden the even more powerful smell of peppermint. the traitor, was dying. Ryan knew the traitor was dying,